really its own creature, so to speak. I gave you the outline on the sheet. It really could be labeled chapters 6 and 7 because it overlaps a lot. But we start out as Ahasuerus is not able to sleep, and the scroll of records, the royal records, is brought before Ahasuerus, and they find, that Mordechai saved the life of Ahasuerus from the plot of Bigtan and Teresh. Ahasuerus asks, what have we done for him? Nothing's been done for him. Who is out in the yard? Haman is out in the yard. Ahasuerus says to Haman, what should be done for somebody whom the king wishes to honor? And he says, oh, I don't know, dress him up like he's the king and parade him around the city, saying this is the one the king wants to honor. And in the text itself, it says, Haman is thinking, who else is going the king want to honor? The king wants to honor me, obviously. So, you know, this is my make-a-wish opportunity. So that's what I think should be done. And Ahasuerus says, good idea. Go do that for Mordechai. Parade him around the city. And Haman parades Mordechai around the city and comes back to his house grieving and upset, tells Zeresh and his beloved family about it, and they give him wise advice. And they say, if you started to fall before Mordechai, yeah, it's kind of over now. You might as well just hang it up, so to speak. Bad word choice, sorry. And then they show up ready to take Haman to the party. So the themes in this chapter that I want to explore are the tension between God making things happen and human beings making things happen, because you're going to see that carry through this chapter and into chapter 7. I also would like to talk about the perspective of the non-Jew on the Jew, because that's a major part of this chapter, and I think a part that people kind of ignore when they read it. I don't know if we're going to get to it today, but we'll see. And then third, I want to talk about masks. Masks and costumes and not the N95 kind. I mean, the Purim kind. But I want to talk about masks and costumes and how it relates to this chapter. Also, that we're definitely not getting to this week. So I want to start out with the parade. The parade here is fascinating, but the major question I have to ask about it is, why does this parade actually matter? Does this parade mean anything in terms of the events of Megillat Esther? And I'll start that conversation by asking, what would you consider the pivotal point in the Book of Esther where we switch from being a story of galut, of exile, to become a story of ge'ulah, of redemption? Where is the pivot point? What would you say?
I think Mordechai on the horse.
Mordechai on the horse. Why?
He's elevated.
Sorry?
Elevated.
So Mordechai is elevated. Okay, but at this point, he's still a dead man. Right? I mean, Haman is still planning to hang him when he's on the horse. There's still a decree against the Jews. But you see, you're saying the elevation of Mordechai on the horse is the middle point, sort of the fulcrum on which the lever is going to shift the momentum. Okay, could be. What else?
I may be wrong, but to me it's when Esther reveals things. Because everything's happening fast now. Suddenly the Jews are going to be free and they even have the right to kill. And like the whole thing just changes on a dime.
So you could make that argument, but that's already sort of well into the process, right? That's the momentum may have shifted earlier, and I think that's what Chana was saying. Yes, Chana.
I think that the fact that what Haman planned for himself came to the Jew now, so it's reversing that thing.
Right. No, that's certainly true. What else would you see, Susan?
I think it's the moment that Ahasuerus begins to recognize that Mordechai has saved his life.
Mm. So it's when he hears the story, you know, when he can't sleep and then he hears the story read.
Right.
Okay, definitely a big moment for sure. You could argue it's when Esther is first accepted by the king, back in chapter 5. Right? When she goes to Achashverosh, and instead of saying off with her head, he extends the sharvit, the scepter, you could make the argument that that's when it is. Based on what we saw... Yeah, Joyce.
Can we say that it's when Esther has the ability to ignore Mordechai's wishes and she has the party on her own terms?
Is that ignoring his wishes?
Well, she didn't do what he wanted her to do. She was politically correct.
What did he want her to do?
He wanted her to go into Achashverosh's chambers and spill the news, but she was politically correct and she knew how to treat Achashverosh
I agree with you that this is her plan, but I don't see that it's against Mordechai's wishes, meaning Mordechai just says go to Achashverosh. He has no plan for how to do it. And she's the one who comes up with the plan. I wouldn't read it as against his wishes, but I mean, to the point that you're making, it's, you know, you could argue that her actions are the pivot in the book. You can say that, Toby.
Well, I think the Jews are still in danger until almost the very end, when they're allowed to defend themselves. There's still a decree against them. There are still people, cities trying to slaughter them.
True. But on the other hand, again, you know, the question is, I'm thinking about a position in the Megillah where the momentum changes, not necessarily where you're already out of trouble. I'm wondering about shifts in momentum. I want to point you to something that we saw back in chapter 5, where we suggested that it's Achashverosh's sleepless night or Mordechai's ride on the horse that is the midpoint, so to speak. We looked at Rabbi David Sabato's structure and how he showed Haman's arc, how Haman is going up, 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 up in stages, and then he hits the point that is supposed to be his height. When the king asks him, what do you do for somebody I want to honor? And then the downside as he loses everything, bit by bit, so that the midpoint is the conversation of Haman with Achashverosh. That's one way to look at it. We also looked at the pairs of events in the Megillah. And we saw that you have pairs of events in which one member of the set happens before, when things are bad, and one member of the set happens when things are better. So Esther's visits to Achashverosh in chapter 5 and chapter 8. The first visit to Achashverosh is a shock when he actually agrees to talk to her. In chapter 8, is normal. In chapter 5, Esther holds a party, but doesn't get anywhere with it. In chapter 7, Esther holds a party and saves the Jews. In chapter 5, Haman meets with his family, and the result is, let's kill Mordechai. In chapter 6, Haman meets with his family, and the result is, you're in trouble, Mordechai's gonna beat you. Haman meets with Achashverosh in chapter 3, and the result is a decree against the Jews. Haman meets with Achashverosh in chapter 6, and the result is parade Mordechai around the city. So you have these events that occur in pairs, and they sort of point to something that's in between the first member of the set and the second member of the set. And what's in between, fundamentally, is the events in the beginning of chapter 6 when Achashverosh can't sleep and orders Mordechai to be paraded around the city. That does seem to be the fulcrum. But here I come back to the question I asked you a couple of minutes ago, which is, why do the events of this chapter matter at all? What really has to happen, right? If you ask a kid who learned the story in school, what really has to happen is Esther has to say to Achashverosh, Haman wants to destroy me and my nation. That's what has to happen in order for the Jews to be saved. If Mordechai rides on the horse and then goes back to sitting at the king's gate, And then Esther doesn't do anything further. All the Jews are gone on the 13th day of Adar. This story hasn't changed what's happening. Jeanette.
So I think that what changes, again, in and of itself, if you just take that moment, 100%. Nothing changed. One little good thing happened in the midst of something so much bigger. But if we look at the Megillah as a series of what could appear as natural coincidences that all add up to a tremendous geula, this is critical.
Why?
Him waking up, Ahasuerus waking up that night, Ahasuerus that turning to that Zavka, that chapter, reading that chapter, him realizing that he didn't, Haman being downstairs, all those little pieces are Hashem's hands in the world that seem hidden, that aren't the splitting of the sea, but seem hidden, and are the pieces that we have to put together to realize that Hashem orchestrated the whole thing.
So that's a beautiful idea, but I ask you, where did all those little pieces lead? Mordechai went around the city, he had his day in the sun, and then he went back to the gate. What happened as a result of this parade?
Well, we suggested, I think last week, I don't remember who suggested it, but someone suggested that putting that idea, reminding Ahasuerus of Mordechai before Esther revealed what was happening, might have impacted it.
How?
Because Mordechai's a good guy. He remembers him. He remembers Mordechai saved his life.
But Esther didn't mention anything to the king about Mordechai.
But he knows he's a Jew.
Ah,
right.
So,
suggested it last.
So here's one idea, which I think is what you're thinking of, which is that Mordechai is elevated in the eyes of the king as a loyalist. So that in chapter 7, not so much from what Esther is going to say, but Charvona is going to say to Ahasuerus, Haman wants to kill Mordechai as a traitor,
right?
A 50 amma gallows for a traitor. He knows Mordechai is no traitor. So that's one explanation for why this story on a practical level matters. Another way this story matters on a practical level is that Ahasuerus develops his suspicion of Haman. Because Haman is now, we already wondered, hey, why is Haman invited to the party? But now he sees Haman talking about giving royal garb to someone and parading them around the city. And that causes Ahasuerus to doubt Haman's loyalty. And then I'll give you a third point, which never, ever, ever occurred to me. I love things like this. Tell me something. How did Charvona know that Haman had a gallows on which he was planning to hang Mordechai? People are frozen, and that means it's probably my computer if I'm seeing multiple people frozen.
You said it was awesome.
Isn't it that thing?
Uh-oh. Hang on, folks. Sorry?
Best advice, no?
So I'm not hearing you well. My computer, I think, is dealing with some issues. So, can you repeat that, Hannah?
Okay.
Hannah, can you say it again?
I thought gallows.
Yeah.
And now maybe that's a. I was wondering why the Midrash says that Eliyahu Levin came.
Right.
Otherwise, I don't understand why the Midrash came in.
Good. So that's one answer to the question. I don't know who can hear me at this point and who can't, because my computer's been funny and some people are moving on my screen and some people are frozen. But I'm going to talk as though you can hear me. As Chana says, this is one reason why the Medrash says that Charvona is really Eliyahu. It's in order to say that's how Charvona knows about the gallows. That's one explanation.
Isn't it
it just as simple they saw it?
No, because he doesn't, by seeing it, you don't know that it's meant for Mordechai.
Well, who else? You knew that, tension between them, like, couldn't he just, you're frozen again, no?
I hear you, but no, there's no evidence that it would have been for Mordechai. Haman is a big guy in the kingdom. Haman's is in charge of everything. There's no reason to assume that this is specifically for Mordechai. I'm going to turn off my video just to see if that helps a little bit. So, I'm still here. Yes, it's possible that people guess, but it's exceedingly unlikely that that's what's going on, that they made that guess. I'm going to float a third idea, which is Malbim's idea. If you take a look on the sheet at source number 6, Malbim points out that at the end of the chapter, Haman is talking to his family, and his family says to him, you know, you started to descend before Mordechai. That's it. You're going to fall before him. And then sentence 14, the last sentence in the chapter, Odam medabrim imo. They're still talking with him. They're still talking with Haman. V'sarisei hamelech higiu. And the king's men showed up to bring him to the party. So take a look at the Malbim. Gam zehaya b'hashgacha, he says, this was also by divine supervision. Shasarisim ba'u be'emtza havikuach. The king's agents show up in the middle of this debate that's going on about Mordechai. V'sham'u et hanidbar b'nehem. They heard what was being talked about. Shaman amar sherotzeh od lihishtadel etz ha'melech litzloto. They heard that Haman wants to hang Mordechai. V'hem yatzuhu bal yilach imimo. And the family is saying, no, don't start up with Mordechai. U'mizeh yada charvona shayacha ben asarisim ha'ela shasa Haman et ha'etz. Charvona is one of the sarisim. So Charvona hears this and reports that into the king. So according to this, there's a third benefit that emerges from the story in this chapter. One benefit is, as Jeanette wanted to say, that the king is now going to find Mordechai to be loyal. A second benefit is that Ahasuerus becomes more suspicious of Haman. And then you have this third idea that the agents find out that Mordechai wants to hang Haman, and that's what leads to Charvona's report, which in the end is what sinks Haman. Clear? We have it? It's very weird that you're not able to see me, but I have to leave the video off right now, to at least while the signal is poor. Yeah.
When the king walked in on Haman over Esther, didn't that sink him?
So, interestingly, no. But we'll see that when we get to chapter 7. You can peek ahead and look at chapter 7 and you'll see what I mean. So on a practical level, you can see how this story leads to Haman's downfall in little ways. I might also add, and I think this is important and it speaks to the theme of the Jew and the non-Jew in this book, we always think of Mordechai's parade in terms of the impact on Mordechai. But consider that Mordechai is going around the city with a big proclamation, this is what the king does for those whom the king wants to honor, right? So in other words, this is the everybody in the city finding out that Mordechai is somebody they want to honor, and now, afterwards, when the decree is made that the Jews are allowed to defend themselves, maybe that gives everybody pause, because everybody is still allowed to attack the Jews. It's just that we're allowed to defend ourselves. Why didn't everybody just attack us and outnumber us? And the answer may well be, they don't attack us because Mordechai is somebody the king wants to honor. So in that sense, there's another impact here. But what I want to show you, beyond the practical impact of this story, hang on one second, Janine. What I want to show you is that beyond that, this chapter plays into the overall themes of the book as well in significant ways. Yes, Janine.
I just wanted to say that the other impact was on the Jews that saw one of their own honored in that way. It must have given them some sort of hope also.
Yes, I think it does. It does give them that kind of encouragement. Yeah, no, I think you're right. I think it gives them an element of chizuk. It gives them an element of encouragement as well. I would agree with that. I want to review the events of the chapter from two thematic perspectives. And they're not mutually exclusive. I know some of you are going to like one, and some of you are going to like the other. And I think that actually, you can like both, because I don't think, like I said, I don't think they're mutually exclusive. Let's start out from Ahasuerus's inability to sleep. Why can't Ahasuerus sleep? What's the deal? Why is he an insomniac suddenly? Why can't Ahasuerus sleep? We don't know that about him.
Maybe he's worried about Esther and Haman.
Right. So one possibility is he's worried about Esther and Haman. And what's the other possibility?
Maybe he's worried about another, being killed again or somebody.
Okay. I would lump that in with Esther and Haman. Yes, Ellen.
Maybe he has the noise of building the gallows.
The noise from the gallows. That's how far away Haman's house was.
Could it be another sign of that was of God again?
Yeah. The other possibility is this is divine intervention. God doesn't want Ahasuerus to sleep. Take a look at source number 7, please. The Gemara in Megillah. And in the interest of time, I'm going to read out my English translation just because there's a lot of text. The text says, the Megillah says, that night the king's sleep was disturbed. Balayla hahu nadida shnat hamelech. So Rabbi Tarnchum said, nadida shnat malko shel olam, the sleep of the king of the universe was disturbed. You may be familiar with a custom that some have, that when they lay in the Megillah, they actually do the Yamim Noraim tune for Hamelech, the High Holidays tune. So they'll do Hamelech. To say that this king is actually king with a capital K.
You're not coming in well.
You're not going to hear me well, Susan. That's what happens when the bandwidth is low. There's nothing to be done about it, but deal. So one possibility, actually there is one other thing I can do. I take that back. Let me see. I'm going to open up Zoom on my phone and see if it does any better. And if it does, then I'll do that. Hold on one second. Meetings. And start. Hang on one second.
You mean this on purpose because you want to be behind a mask?
Nope, not really. Okay, can you hear? Oh, wait, I'm on mute.
Not on right now.
There we go. Okay, I am on. Can you see me?
Yes.
Okay, good. So I'm going to kill the other one, the other me, so to speak. Let me see if I can do that and still be host. Oh, I see how I can do it. Yes, I should be able to do it. Okay. There we go. Okay.
We see you.
Okay, so the only downside is I won't be able to see you guys because I can only see a certain number of screens on the phone. But all right, let's get moving here. What the Gemara in Megillah says here is Rabbi Tanchum says it's that God couldn't sleep, not that Ahasuerus.
Because it's written Hamelech, Nadadash not Hamelech.
So Ruchama wants to say, Ruchama.
Yes.
Okay. הבעיה היא שאי אפשר לכתוב משהו אחר, צריך לכתוב המלך.
זהו, no, but this is why he explained that המלך is הקדוש ברוך הוא.
So Ruchama wants to suggest that the fact that the definite object is used, it says the king couldn't sleep, leads to the thought that it's God. My response to her is, you didn't have another way to do it. You needed the definite object. You couldn't have said, after that, king couldn't sleep. It has to say, the king. What Rabbi Tanchum is picking up on is much more than language. Rabbi Tanchum is picking up on the idea that God is the one who is making sure Achashverosh won't be able to sleep, and I want to come back to why he's so sure of that in a few minutes. But this is one school of thought, is that God is the one who can't sleep in this story. That's one view. Then you get a second view in the Gemara here. The Rabbanan, the sages, said the upper realms were disturbed, the lower realms were disturbed, which Rashi explains means the malachim, the angels, were actually disturbing Achashverosh. They made it so that Achashverosh could not sleep. They said to him, you're kfui tova, you're an ingrate, you didn't reward Mordechai, and so on. So that's a second school, which also says that Achashverosh's sleep is disturbed by some form of intervention. And then you get Rava. And Rava says, no, Achashverosh actually couldn't sleep. The actual sleep of King Achashverosh. A thought fell into his mind. He said, what is this that Esther invited Haman? Perhaps they're taking counsel against that man, that's the royal third person, right? Maybe they're taking counsel against me, they want to kill me. Then Achashverosh said, well, if so, isn't there anyone who likes me who will tell me? Why is it that nobody is letting me know about these plots? There's no informant. And then he said, well, you know what? Maybe there's somebody who helped me in the past, and I didn't pay him back. And so people are refraining from revealing this to me. There's no point in assisting the king against the plot if you're not going to get rewarded for it anyway. And so he said, bring me the book of records, bring me the chronicles. So within this school of thought, Achashverosh is being manipulated by Esther, and that's why he can't sleep. Esther had inviting Haman to the party is what causes Haman to be unable to sleep. That's the idea. Now, there's more to say about that also. I just want to add one nuance to this from the Malbim in source number 8. The Malbim suggests that Esther's wording fed into this as well. It's not just about inviting Haman. Take a look at number 8. V'yan shekifla b'dvareha im matzasi chen v'im al ha-melech tov. Because Esther doubled her words. She said, if I have found favor, and if it's good in the eyes of the king. Achashverosh hears that. And he says, you know what? Hivin sh'ela sh'tivakesh hu davar ha-tov lifnei ha-melech be'atzmo. Achashverosh says, it's not just something she's requesting if she is good in my eyes. It's something she is requesting that she thinks is going to be good itself in my eyes. Something that's appropriate for me as a righteous king. Basheru Moshel Amim v'uchan b'chesed kiso, a ruler of nations, somebody whose throne is founded on generosity. So he starts to think, you know what? This is my fault. I didn't reward someone for something, and therefore, he calls for the record. So Malbim adds a nuance to how Esther's words could have actually led to this point. But what I'm trying to suggest here, and I don't know if anyone is raising their hand because on the phone, again, I can't see everybody. So for all I know, people want to speak up, and I apologize that I can't see you. But there are two different approaches to Achashverosh's inability to sleep. Some suggest, in this Gemara, that God is making Achashverosh unable to sleep. This is divine manipulation. And some suggest that this is not divine manipulation, this is Esther's human manipulation. Esther is the reason Achashverosh can't sleep. You follow? Both of those are here. So, having said that, just wanted to see if there's a way to see more people, but there isn't. Oh well, never mind. Having said that, I think it's worth it to walk through the events of this chapter from each perspective. From the perspective that this is divine manipulation, and from the perspective that this is actually Esther's manipulation. So I'm going to pause. Did anybody have anything that a comment they wanted to make before we go further? No, we're good? Okay. I actually figured, I can see more people now, so this can work. Okay. First perspective. Evidence that this is divine manipulation. Okay? That this is God actually moving the pieces around. Hold on one second. Okay. Evidence that this is God moving the pieces around. So on your sheet in source number 9, I gave you a little shorthand for this. Fasts, disturbed sleep, and passive voice. And here's what I mean by that. Back in chapters 4 and 5, Esther moved God. Right? She had the Jews fast, number one. And number two, in inviting Haman to the party, we suggested also she's trying to gain divine sympathy. But more than that, and this goes back to the question of why the Gemara thinks that it is that Hashem is disturbing Achashverosh's sleep. We have a pattern in Tanakh that God disturbs the sleep of non-Jewish kings as part of moving a story forward. Can you tell me an example of a non-Jewish king whose sleep God disturbed? Yes, Chana?
Yeah, when Sarah was kidnapped.
Right. By Avimelech. Yeah. Specifically the kidnapping of Avimelech, that is correct. Not with Paro, interestingly. But when Avimelech kidnaps Sarah, God sends Avimelech a dream in the night, warning him to release her. That's one example. When else? Yes, Janine.
Paro.
Right? Paro can't sleep and he has those two dreams. He wakes up. Alina, you were going to say? Nebuchadnezzar also has dreams that frighten him in the second parak as well as in the fourth parak. Good. Who else?
Lavan
is... sorry? Lavan is not a king.
Lavan.
Right, but he's not a king. The other one is not really a sleep disturbance. It's a more a nighttime disturbance, and that would be Belshazzar. But that's at night, but it's not a disturbance of sleep. So I think I'll take him out. But if you take a look on your sheet at source number 10, you'll see what I think are important sentences in Iyov. Those of you who were here when we learned Iyov, this is a blast from the past. Iyov in chapter 33 is hearing a speech from Elihu. Elihu is a cryptic figure in the book of Iyov. He's not there, and suddenly he's there. And he gives a moralizing speech to Iyov, to Job, about what God does and how God runs the world. So look at what he says here. And I didn't bring you a translation, because I always ask you to have a Tanakh with you. So I thought about not even bringing the Hebrew. But then I said, I'll bring the Hebrew, fine. But I'm not also bringing the English. You can look in your Tanakh for that. He says in this passage that God prods people at night. Bachalom chezion laila, in a dream, in a vision of the night. Binafol tardema al anashim, when sleep falls upon people. Bisnumos ale mishkav, in slumber upon their bed. When people are asleep, at that point, they get this chalom, the dream, chezion alayla, a vision of the night. Az yigla ozen anashim, that point, God opens the ears of men. Uvumos saram yachtom, La'asir adam ma'aseh ve'geva migever yechaseh. God does this in order to steer people straight, in order to get people to stop being arrogant. God sends them messages while they are sleeping at night. Yachsoch nafsho minishachat, in order that he might save himself from destruction, in order to save his life from the sword of the angel of death, the shalach. So here what you see is a message that God will speak to people at night in order to send them a message that will get them to right their ways. You contrast, though, the non-Jewish kings with the Jewish kings. Shlomo HaMelech, King Solomon, received messages at night from God in Malachim Aleph, Kings 1, chapter 6 and chapter 9. And those may have been while he was sleeping, but they're direct messages. They're not dreams. They're not allegories. Here, what we're talking about is people getting visions they don't really understand. Abimelech understood his message. But Paro didn't understand his message. Nebuchadnezzar did not understand his message. And Achashverosh can't sleep at all. There is no dream message here for Achashverosh. Achashverosh is below Lavan, Paro, and Nebuchadnezzar. Right? Lavan got a direct message from God. God told him what he wanted him to do. Paro and Nebuchadnezzar got visions they didn't understand. Achashverosh just can't sleep. He's sort of lower in status in that way. But that idea, this history of God disturbing the sleep of kings, is perhaps what's informing the Gemara in saying that Achashverosh was not able to sleep. But more than that, another piece of evidence that that this is being manipulated by God outside of the story is the language of the text itself. If you look at Perek Vav, chapter 6, sentences 1 and 2, Chana, you were going to say this? Right. Right. And it's not just that. You're right. But look at the whole section. Nadadashnat HaMelech, the king's sleep was shifted, which is in of itself odd. But then keep on reading. Pasuk Aleph, sentence 1 there, chapter 6. He said, Lahaviyat Sefer HaZichronot Divrei HaYamim, he told them to bring the Book of Memorials, the Book of Chronicles. Malbim actually has a nice discussion about the difference between Sefer Zichronot and Divrei HaYamim, but I'm not going into that now. Vayihyu Nikraim Lifnei HaMelech. So Chana points out, it doesn't say, and they read them before the king. It said, and they were read before the king. And then the next sentence, Vayimatse Chatuv. And it was found to be recorded that Mordechai had told about Bigtan and Teresh and so on. Right? It's all in the passive voice, indicating someone outside is actually moving these events. Take a look, please, at source number 11 and see what the Gemara does with it. Vayihyu nikraim, and they were read. Milamech nikraim me'elehen. It teaches that they were read on their own. The scribes, whoever's there and responsible to read them aloud, don't want to read them aloud. It is read on its own. Vayimatzei chatuv. And it was found to be written. So the text in the Gemara says it should say katav. I'm not clear on what katav would have helped, and I've read others who have wrestled with that as well. Katav doesn't seem right. But the point is still the passive voice that's there. It was found recorded. This teaches that Shimshai erased and Gavriel recorded. Who remembers who Shimshai was?
Son of Haman.
Nope. Who is Shimshai? He may be a son of Haman, but not named that way in the Megillah. Those of you who were here when we did Ezra and Nehemiah, who was Shimshai? In Ezra chapter 4, Shimshai was the scribe who wrote away to the Persians to say that the Jews are going to rebel. That we're building up the walls of Jerusalem and we are going to stop paying taxes and all of that. Shimshai is a scribe who acts to undermine the Jews. So the Gemara says, Shimshai is a scribe working for the Persians who doesn't like us. He's the one. Shimshai doesn't want to say anything good about Mordechai, so Shimshai erases, and the Malach Gavriel is there writing. And so it was found to be written not by human hand, but rather by Malach. You follow? So what we're getting at here is this. This story is important. First of all, we've said there are certain practical ways in which this story is important. It does help with certain elements of the story. Achashverosh's suspicion of Haman, Mordechai's elevation in the eyes of the king, the Charbona potentially learning about Haman's plot, the Jews in Shushan as well as the non-Jews in Shushan seeing Mordechai elevated. These are all practical benefits of this story. Also, viewing this story as God's manipulation, this is an extended scene of God moving things around, getting involved, the hallmark of Ge'ulah, the hallmark of redemption. And so that's another way to look at this story as being the fulcrum, because you see extended involvement by God in order to make things happen. He keeps Achashverosh from sleeping. He causes this to be read. Gavriel is writing it in as Shimshai erases it. And what we're going to see next, God willing, next time, is the other half of this, which is reading the story not as God manipulating Achashverosh, but as Esther manipulating Achashverosh. So we will see as well how this story is an extended scene of Esther manipulating things and Achashverosh being led to suspect Haman. So we're gonna have to come back to that next week. There's a lot more to be said about this chapter, and also costumes. We want to talk Purim costumes next week as well. So if you want to show up in costume, that's just fine. Hopefully my internet connection will be better also next week. Thank you very much.